So welcome to our weekly colloquium. Thank you everyone for logging on and joining us. Before we get started, does anyone have any announcements that they need to make or would like to make or share? I do want to bring people's attention to, and I'll see if I can get to it quickly anyway. The Genetics and Genomics Academy is hosting a Stories from the Genetics and Genomics Academy event, which is produced by Story Collider, which will be this Thursday night at 6 p.m. If you are interested in attending this, I think it's going to be really interesting. Fred Gould, who is co-director of the GES Center, will be sharing his story as one of the participants. But I think the other people who will be sharing also have very interesting stories. So if you would like to get tickets to that, go to storycollider.org or just Google NC State GGA Story Collider, and you should be able to get your free tickets there. So with that, if anyone else has any announcements, raise your hand really quickly. Otherwise, I'm going to stop sharing and allow Rebecca to introduce our speaker for today.
Good afternoon, everyone. Today, I'll be introducing Dr. Stephen Heine, professor of social and cultural psychology and a distinguished university scholar at the University of British Columbia. He has published quite a few articles on the topics of cultural and social psychology and received multiple awards for his contributions to the field of psychology and social sciences. In 2017, he published his book called DNA is Not Destiny, and also is also very well known for his best-selling textbook called Cultural Psychology. Which reviews State as the most contemporary introduction to the field of psychology and unmatched in its presentation of current and global experimental research. He was elected as a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada in 2016 and continues in his research interests related to self, the pursuit of meaningful life, essentialistic thinking, and inequality, and also health. Today, he will be talking about how people's knowledge of genetics and hereditary conditions can impact a negative or positive approach to their circumstances, as well as the results of a few psychological experiments that show how essentialistic bias can create a gap between common beliefs and the reality of genetic causation. Without further ado, please join me in welcoming Dr. Stephen Heine.
Great. Thanks so much, Rebecca, for that very generous introduction. I'm really happy to get to talk with you today. It's unfortunate I wasn't able to make it to see you guys in person. That's unfortunate. Hopefully we'll have some chance to talk in the question period though. I'm gonna share my screen. So hopefully you can see my slides here. As Rebecca noted, I'm a psychologist, a cultural psychologist, so I imagine I'm bringing a somewhat different perspective to this topic than you've heard before. I thought I would first just share how I got interested in this topic, because most of what I've done in my research is comparing the ways of thinking between people from different cultures. And we often would find some pronounced differences in their ways of thinking, and I would often get two specific critical reactions to this work that I found really curious and made me think a lot. One of them, after I would give a talk and say, "Oh, we found these cultures differ in these ways," one critical reaction I would get is people would say, "Your results must be due to some kind of artifact, because we know the human genome is so homogeneous around the world that we couldn't have these pronounced differences in ways of thinking." And another reaction I would get, say, "Wow, these differences are really fascinating. I think they suggest that there must be pronounced genetic differences between populations to get such differences in ways of thinking." And I found this really curious, because our whole argument, and actually really what I think our research points to quite clearly, is that people's cultural experiences do shape how they think. But for many people in the audience here, they didn't seem to find that a compelling explanation for how we could come to think in the ways that we do. And rather, there seemed to be this sense that, unless genes are involved, we haven't really fundamentally explained something. And so that led me for several years here, trying to understand a bit better about why genes weigh so heavily in the ways that we make sense of our world. And this research I've done in collaboration, in particular with my former grad students, Ilan Darnimrod, Ben Chung, and Anita Schmaller. So I want to consider the question, why do people tend to be so fatalistic towards genes and find genetic arguments to be so deterministic? And I think a way of understanding this goes back to one of the best documented human universals in psychology, meaning that it's found all around the world, every society it's been looked at. And that's a bias which we call psychological essentialism. And what this means is that people have some strong intuitions that the natural world is the way that it is because of some force from some hidden underlying essences that make it so. Inside, deep down, there are these strong forces that make the world the way that it is. And so people will turn to essences to make sense of differences that they see in the social world as well. We project to the social world from the natural world. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about what this psychological essentialism entails. So one intuition that people have about essences is that they are the ultimate causes for something. So why is a dog like a dog, right? Why does it like to play fetch and have its belly rubbed and so on? Well, ultimately, this is due to its essence. It's not because it's raised that way that a dog has all of those characteristics deep inside from the moment it's born. Okay. Another intuition people have is that these essences underlie the natural world. So this is clearly not a lion. You can't change a dog into a lion. And even young children have this intuition quite strongly. So one experiment by Frank Kyle found with five-year-old children that they were told that a doctor had taken a raccoon and he had trimmed the fur and he dyed it black and painted a white stripe down its tail and then sewed on a sack of stinky fluids. And then they asked the kids, "What is this?" And the kids at 5 years old reliably replied, "Well, that's just a raccoon that's made to look like a skunk." You can't change an animal. You can't change an animal because you can't change its underlying essence. However, the same children had no problem in concluding that a coffee maker that was changed to make itself into a bird feeder was now a bird feeder. So artifacts are not seen to emerge from an underlying essence, only the natural world. Okay? Another intuition that people have about essences is that they're deep down and inside us, and they affect us from being inside us. And so, for example, one study with American university students, they were told about a fictitious people called the Chandorans who live on an island. And they're told that the Chandorans hunt two kinds of animals. They hunt sea turtles and they hunt wild boars. However, one half of the students are told that the Chandorans, even though they hunt both animals, they only eat the turtle meat and they use the tusks from the boars for decoration that they wear on them. Whereas the other group was told that they only eat the boar meat and that they use the turtle fur, its shell, for decorations on them. And then the students were asked some questions about what they thought the Chandorans were like. And what the results suggested was that the turtle-eating Chandorans were thought to be more peaceful, rather slow, good swimmers, whereas the boar-eating Chandorans were thought to be quite aggressive, quite fast-paced, quite competitive. The idea is that after you've consumed something that's inside you can potentially come to affect you in ways that wearing something can't, that our behaviors are guided by these forces deep down inside us. Another intuition that people have about essences is that they're immutable, that they can't be changed. This book is a memoir written by Claire Sylvia, who was the first heart-lung transplant recipient in New England. And she wrote this describing her experiences. And her donor was a man who was killed in a motorcycle accident. And at the time of his death, they found on his body that he had a half-eaten bag of chicken McNuggets and some cans of beer. After she received his heart, Claire Sylvia reports that all of a sudden she had these strange cravings for chicken McNuggets and beer. And her children said that she started, you know, lumbering around the house like a linebacker. All she seemed to feel that she had taken on all the qualities of her donor. And this is actually a very common experience. About one third of heart donors report this sensation that they've taken on the qualities of their donor, such that now it's become a standard practice to not inform people of the identity of their donor for a couple of years. So after they've gotten used to having their new heart. But the idea that this essence of this man was still operating when it was inside Claire Sylvia's body, the people have strong intuitions that this could be. And another intuition about essences is that they draw the boundaries of categories. They carve nature at its joints. And so one study by the anthropologist Francisco Gil White, he studied two groups that live in Mongolia, the Urangkai and the Torgud. And they're different in the sense that the Urangkai has a cultural practice where they believe that they can cast magic curses, whereas the Torguds don't. And so the anthropologist posed a thought experiment to his participants there and saying, well, if a child, an Urangkai child, was adopted at birth and raised by the Torgud, would it be able to cast these magical curses? And the most common answer, participants said that, yes, they'd be able to, but they would never know it. So they never would. Kind of like Harry Potter growing up with some muggles. But the idea then that the different groups have different essences, and this is what distinguishes them from each other, and this is what distinguishes their abilities as well. And the last intuition about essences that people share is that they can be transferred. And so Paul Rosen at the University of Pennsylvania asked American students there whether they would be willing to try on a sweater that used to belong to Hitler. And common reactions, many students said, no, I wouldn't be willing to do this. And he's like, well, what if it's thoroughly dry cleaned? Would you then be willing to try on this sweater? And still many students balked at the idea, suggesting that somehow they thought that this sweater had been contaminated by Hitler's evil essence, that it had spilled over onto the sweater. And if they wore it, it might spill over onto themselves. Okay. And so it's with these kinds of intuitions that people have about essences guides how they think about the natural world and how the natural world comes to be. And what research suggests is we don't think about essences directly. What we do is that there are various placeholders that we rely on, some concrete placeholder, and we project all of these intuitions about essences on them. And that's how we understand how these things operate. And just some examples of some of these essence placeholders that we've relied on throughout history, for instance, throughout 2000 years of Western medicine, the four humors of Hippocrates were believed to underlie people's health and to underlie their personality. So the kind of person you are and your state of health all depends on this balance of these underlying four humors that somehow they elicit this force onto our personalities, onto our health. Psychology in the early 19th century believed in phrenology, where the idea that you had these lumps on your head, which underlying neural structures there that somehow made you just who you are in this kind of magical way that was never explained. Alchemy throughout the Middle Ages, there's a belief that each element here has its underlying essence. And the only way that you could change the essence of lead into the essence of gold was with various chemical experiments and having a philosopher's stone making the right magical chance that these elements have different underlying essences. And various cultures have different ideas about essences too. I spend a lot of time in Japan, and people always want to know my blood type in Japan because there's the sense that there's four different personality types that correspond with the four different blood types. People believe that somehow your blood type affects the personality that you have. In China, there's a belief of qi, this force of vitality that exists within us that makes things as they are. Yogic traditions have similar ideas about prana, and we can see similar ideas in popular culture with the force in Star Wars. Okay, so that there's various kinds of placeholders that we project all our intuitions about essences. And I think that the lay person's understanding about genes makes a very effective placeholder for essences. That is that we project these intuitions about essences onto genes because they overlap so tightly with our understanding, with our intuitions about essences. For example, that many lay people would say that our genes come ultimately from God. That's how we get them. They're unique to us, you know, barring an identical twin, we all have a unique one-off genome. From the very moment that your life had any kind of beginning, from conception throughout your life until your death, your genes are largely the same, and that they can continue to identify you after your death. TV shows like CSI remind us just how the tiniest speck of you continues to hold your identity. And, you know, we've even sequenced Neanderthals that this goes on for a very long time. We can transfer our genes to our kids. Half of our genes go to our kids, and our genes remain deep and hidden inside us and there. And every part of us, every little speck of us has our genes. And people think that genes are ultimately what make us who we are. And so my main argument here is that when most people are thinking about genes, I don't think they really are thinking about genes. I think they're thinking about essences and all of the intuitions that they have about essences. And that's guiding their reasoning when they think about how genes shape the world. With former grad student Ilan Dar-Nimrod, we proposed that there is a set of genetic essentialist biases which influence how people think about genes. One, that people tend to think about genetic causes as immutable. That is that they can't be changed. So, for instance, if you would learn that your romantic partner has the right number of loops of DRD4 gene, at least the nucleotides in the DRD4 gene, which is sometimes known as the infidelity gene, you might be especially worried that your partner someday is going to be unfaithful to you. That it's in their genes, that they can't help it. It's going to happen. Okay. Another bias that we propose here is that genetic causes appear to have a specific etiology. That is, people perceive them as having a one-to-one cause and effect. So that if you get a particular disease that's proposed to have a genetic basis, then you assume that you must have that gene. And if you don't have the disease, then that would indicate that you don't have the underlying genes. The people often think about these in having a one-to-one correspondence. Another genetic essentialist bias is that groups that share genes are viewed as more homogeneous and discrete from other groups. So, for example, if we learn, say, that Chinese people are more likely to share one particular genetic variant, then that makes Chinese people as a group seem more homogeneous, seem more similar to each other, and seem more distinct from non-Chinese people. That thinking about the underlying genes here breaks up the social world into these fundamental categories and carves nature at its joints. And a last bias here that people tend to assume that genes are natural, and people tend to be vulnerable to the naturalistic fallacy, to assume that what is natural is good. So that anything that has a genetic basis then is natural and should be accepted and is at least desirable. And anything that would try to change those genes here would be seen as deeply unnatural, such as genetically modified organisms here going against nature and thus seeming fundamentally problematic. Okay. So I'm interested then in how people come to see the world when they're thinking about genes, when genes are on their mind. How does that shape how they see the world? And in general, and I'm going to show you some research that backs this up, that when people are reminded that genes are relevant to a particular trait, that they come to think of that trait differently. They come to think of that trait in these more essentialized ways. And this is a big issue because, of course, all human qualities here are genetic. That is, there's no gene-free zone within underlying our biology and our behavior. That the first law of behavioral genetics is that all human traits are heritable to some degree. And, you know, the early research into behavioral genetics was looking at a lot of the sort of, you know, key fundamental traits, things such as IQ and fundamental personality factors. But as research continued, it continued to find that, yeah, everything seemed to be heritable. How much TV do you watch? That's heritable. Have you got divorced or not? That turns out to be heritable. Have you been mugged or not? That also turns out to be heritable. And so hearing that genes are involved in these domains that people tend not to think of genes being relevant, I argue changes the way that we think about those domains. Someone who gets divorced, it seems like it's a different kind of a process now when you think that somehow your genes are involved with that. Okay. And I think this is especially relevant because most people don't have a great technical understanding of genes. Most lay people don't have much of a rich understanding of genes, but they make genetic attributions nonetheless. Just to give you an idea where our knowledge of genes sort of stands, one study got a representative sample of American adults, and they asked them a question about genes that I guess most people hadn't really considered before, and that is, where in your body are your genes? Where are they located? And they're obviously in your cells, but fewer than half of people answered that. Fewer half of people knew that genes are in your cells. Rather, looking at their wrong answers, I think are kind of illustrative. The most common wrong answer was that your genes are in your brain, and that's how they influence things like your personality, or your genes are in your groin region, and that's how you can pass them on. So that people don't have great technical understanding of genes, but it's they are not at all reluctant to say that something is genetic. He's acting that way because of his genes, that were readily able to make these kinds of attributions without really understanding genes. And I think really what these attributions are based on their projection of their understanding about essences, this innate understanding about essences. Okay. So I'm going to describe some experiments here that we've done then. And they're largely quite similar in design. And here is an example study. So we had students from the University of British Columbia read one of three different news articles that we provided them. Okay, and these are newspaper coverage of scientific research. One of these articles described how obesity genes affect one's weight. And it was an accurate description of research on so-called obesity genes. Another article describes some research that showed how people's social networks affect one's weight, that on average, our weight is quite similar to people in our social networks, and even the weight of our friends' friends seems to have some impact on our own weight. So our experiences then affect our weight. And a third group reads a control essay that has nothing to do with weight or genes or anything like that. And then we have our participants participate in a food tasting experiment. And we gave them a bunch of cookies that they could sample, and they were asked a bunch of questions about to evaluate the cookies. Really what we were interested in though was how many of those cookies they sampled. We had a scale and we were weighing exactly how many crumbs of cookies that they had consumed. And this is what our results looked like, that those people who had just read about obesity genes tended to eat more cookies than those who were in our control condition or those who learned about environmental effects on our weight. And this is a typical pattern that's going to look similar in other studies that I'll be showing you here, is that we find that when people are presented with a genetic argument, this seems to impact them relative to a control group. When genes are on people's minds, they seem to weigh more heavily on their minds. And that in contrast, when we tell people about ways that the environment or our experiences affect us, they generally don't seem to move people much. That this red bar is not significantly different from the yellow bar. And we had other questions in this survey which revealed that people who had just learned about genes tended to think that obesity genes, they tended to think that your weight was somewhat beyond your control. There's nothing you can do, that it's your genes that are determining your weight. Okay, so this is just one illustration of how when people encounter a genetic argument, it seems to have more weight on them than when they encounter an argument about another kind of causal force. Now I want to just talk about how discussions about genes affect the ways that people understand race and racial differences. And some other research has found that people will come to show a distinct preference for their own racial group over other racial groups when they're told of a biological account of race as opposed to a social account of race, saying that race is ultimately about biology. Then they show a more pronounced bias, preferring their own race. Or even just when people are told about the global distribution of gene frequencies, the idea that gene frequencies are not homogeneously distributed around the world, that idea also leads people to have a more pronounced in-group bias towards their own race. That hearing that genes are involved seems to make people think that, well, people around the world, they're made of different stuff. And so that they really are different then. And so this apparently makes people more willing to also be in favor of treating people differently because they are seen to be made of such different fundamental stuff. We did a related study here to understand how people make sense of differences between populations of people. Are these differences between populations, are they acquired, what people acquire through their lifetime, or are they based on these innate underlying essences? And so we had American Mechanical Turk workers read essays that either described was a geographic distribution of genes. So it was a scientifically accurate article describing how gene frequencies differ around the world. Another group read an article that emphasized the relative homogeneity of the human genome in contrast to other species, in particular contrast to chimpanzees, just how that human genome is rather homogeneous in comparison with many other species. And another group read a control essay that had nothing to do with genes. And then we had participants read a list of ethnic stereotypes. Okay? We had a long list of ethnic stereotypes. So we done some research showing that many people believe in these. And so, for example, that French people have a more refined palate. Africans have a better sense of rhythm. East Asians are better at math. And we had a long list of these stereotypes. And we asked people then how accurate they found each stereotype to be. Did you agree with that stereotype or not? We asked them how offensive they found each stereotype to be. And then we asked them, how much do you think the population difference of French differing from other people and so on was due to genetic causes or was due to some environmental causes, something with their experiences over their lifetime? And we find that overall, people tend to think about 40% of the causes underlying these stereotypes was due to genes. So that genes played a significant role in each of these stereotypes on average. But when they had heard about the notion that gene frequencies vary around the world, they were even more likely to attribute these population differences to genes. In contrast, when they learned of the relative homogeneity of the human genome, they did not tend to have a greater tendency to attribute these stereotypes to genes. Okay. Genetic essentialism and sex. So sex is the most essentialized human construct, meaning that people tend to think of it as fundamental, immutable, and that the groups as discrete from each other. And on average, the more that someone tends to view genes in deterministic ways, the more likely they are to have more sexist views, that these things seem to go together, as Johannes Keller has shown us. Moreover, a number of studies have used experimental manipulations to make people focus on the idea that there are genetic differences between the sexes to make those ideas more salient. And when people were told about how genes distinguish the sexes, they then showed even more pronounced sexist views. And we wanted to explore this idea and to see how it might affect people's understanding of this stereotype of women in math. And so in this study here, we had all of our participants were female students at the University of British Columbia, and we gave them a modified version of the GRE exam, where they first had the very difficult math test, and then they had a verbal test, and then another math test. And inside the verbal test, if you recall, when you probably took the GRE at some point, that there's an essay that they read and had to answer questions about the essay. And so the essay that we included in there is something that we wrote, and we wanted to change how people were thinking about what causes a stereotype of women and worse math performance. And so all of these essays that we made are entirely made up. There's no truth in any of them. But one of the essays that they read, we described that on average, men tend to outperform women in math by about 5 percentage points, and that scientists have discovered that there's some genes on the Y chromosome that contribute to this difference. Okay, so that we're arguing here that this stereotype with women in math is caused by genes. The second essay read that on average, men outperform women by about 5 percentage points on math tests. And social sciences have identified that this is due to the different ways that teachers interact with boys and girls when they teach them math. And it's because of the way that the teachers interact with them that this results in these differences in math performance. And so the difference is due to experiences. And then a third essay that they read said that scientists demonstrate that there are no sex differences in math performance, that this is a false stereotype. Okay, so that's what they've read. And then they get a second math test. And we're interested in how just reading these essays here affects the way that they, if it has any effect on how they perform on the second math test. Okay. And yes, if you see here that this is the number of correct math answers that they got in this test, controlling for how well they did on the first test. And we did the study twice, and we replicated each time, that those who learned that women do worse at math because of their genes, women here in this condition here did significantly worse on this math test compared to those who were told that there was no sex differences in math. And this drop between the blue and the red bars here is an example of a stereotype threat. It's this well-researched phenomenon in psychology that if you are a member of a group that has a negative stereotype about you, and that stereotype is brought to mind, that and you're engaging something that you can have a stand the chance of proving that stereotype, you're taking a very difficult math test and struggling at it, in the end you might sort of prove the stereotype, that you might show the self-fulfilling prophecy. And we see that when women are told about math genes. But when they were told that women's worst performance in math is due to their experiences, we don't get this effect. That it seems that people don't think their experiences they think of their experiences as separate from them, that they can escape their experiences. They don't have to be influenced by their experiences. But they seem to think, this study suggests, that, well, you can't escape your genes. So if the stereotype is due to genes, well, you have those genes with you all the time. You're going to be vulnerable to the stereotype then. Okay. A lot of research has also explored how people's understanding of genes affects how they think about sexual orientation. And a number of studies have found that the more that someone believes that sexual orientation is innate, is due to one's genes, then the more likely are to be in support of gay rights. I think is reflecting this sort of this essentialist bias of genes as natural. So if it's innate, it's natural, and therefore it's good, it's desirable. And other research has found if people read an essay that argues for the biological foundation of sexual orientation, so makes that case to people, those who've read that essay are more in more support for gay rights afterwards. Okay, so here's how essentialism can be associated here with more support for gay rights. Another line of research has explored how people think about mental illness differently when they are reminded of a genetic component to mental illness. So when people learn about the genetic basis of a mental illness, people will feel more sympathetic towards the afflicted. That they tend to think, oh, it's not your fault. You know, and they have a kind, warm, sympathetic response. However, they tend to view a mental illness that has genes involved as more serious than one when they're not reminded that genes are involved. The fact that it seems to have a genetic basis people interpret as being more serious. Likewise, they think if a mental illness has a genetic basis, then it should be treated with medication as opposed to therapy. The idea that if it's, well, deep down inside you, then you need some medication that's going to work deep down inside you. And moreover, that people become more pessimistic in the prognosis of a mental illness if they believe it to have a genetic basis. You're always going to have your genes with you. So perhaps you're always going to be at risk for this mental illness. Okay. So now I want to talk about our research in essentialism and eugenics. I think we're all familiar with the eugenics movement, and we associate, most strong association is with the Nazis, and the idea that some people are of lower genetic worth than others, and that we're a burden, genetic burden to society, and that we needed to identify people based on who had this problematic genetic essence. And here's a couple of statements about the eugenics movement. The multiplication of the feeble-minded was a very terrible danger to the race. Or someday we'll realize that the prime duty, the inescapable duty of the good citizen of the right type is to leave his or her blood behind him in the world. And these are quotations from Winston Churchill and Teddy Roosevelt, respectively. And I use these examples here just to remind us that even though I think eugenics is so associated with Nazis, that in the early part of the 20th century, it was a very widespread idea. And it cut across political lines, both on the left and the right. It was taught in all of the best universities at the time. It was in my field in psychology, virtually all of the key founding fathers in psychology at the first half of the 20th century, they were all involved in the eugenics movement. It was a very widespread idea at the time. And I think there's some links with this thinking that, genes are the fundamental explanation for everything, this essentialist orientation, that this, I think, can point people towards eugenic solutions. And many of the leading early eugenicists had backgrounds in genetics, in particular Francis Galton, who founded both, fields of behavioral genetics and eugenics. And at the time, the early 20th century, that many of the leading geneticists were active in the eugenics movement. There wasn't a whole lot of light between these two fields. And many of the early eugenicists favored really quite simple monogenetic accounts for human traits. So it was proposed, for instance, that feeble-mindedness was based on a single gene. It was a recessive gene is what one account had it. And so that people were sort of imagining this sort of very simple explanation for human traits and for feeble-mindedness in particular. And so a question we want to consider here, well, does attending to genetic causes lead one to have more sympathy for eugenic solutions? And we want to study this in with current individuals just to see what kind of links there might be. And so we created a rather disturbing measure here of support for eugenic policies over reproduction. We made a 15-item survey here that had good psychometric properties. And some of the items are things like there should be tax incentives for people with mental illness to prevent them from having biological children. Sterilization of those possessing undesirable traits, example, mental disorder, is a way to improve future generations. There should be laws discouraging people with low intelligence from having biological children, or anyone convicted of a violent crime should be sterilized as a form of their punishment. Okay, some very hardcore questions. I guess the encouraging news is that most people disagree with these items, okay? But there is quite a bit of variability. And then we also measure people's genetic essentialist thinking with two different measures. And these are two measures we use in many of our studies here. These are some of the items from it. A person with a genetic predisposition for obesity is destined to become fat. Or it is natural to behave aggressively if one has genetic predisposition to aggression. or the environment does not affect the chances of getting cancer for someone with a genetic susceptibility to cancer. That was from one scale, and another scale from Johannes Keller. The fate of each person lies in his or her genes. In my view, many forms of human behavior are biologically determined and can therefore be seen as instinctual. Or in my view, the development of homosexuality in a person can be attributed to genetic causes. Okay, so we wanted to see how well these two scales, genetic essentialist thinking and eugenics, support for eugenics, go together. We had a fairly large sample of American Mechanical Turk workers. And yeah, overall, the means for eugenic acceptance is rather low, 2.81 on a 7-item scale. So if you think of 4 as the midpoint, so it's quite a bit below the midpoint of the scale. Most people are disagreeing with it. These two measures of genetic essentialism correlated quite strongly with this measure of eugenic support, suggesting that there's something quite similar in believing genes are representing our underlying essences and believing that society should be striving to shape its collective genome. Okay. In the same study, we also explored people's attitudes towards genetic engineering, specifically with genetically modified organisms. And genetically modified organisms remains a highly controversial topic. And I think a key reason why it's controversial is that it violates our views that essences should be natural, so that we're interfering with nature here, and whatever we do then would be unnatural. And because of the naturalistic fallacy, would suggest that it's going to be problematic. And so a variety of studies have found, first of all, that There's an enormous gap in approval of GMOs between scientists and the lay public, that scientists in general are in support of GMO on average, the lay public not so much. And I think scientists are so in support because they don't think of genetically modified organisms as that different from any other kind of product that, I mean, crop that is grown, because all genes have been modified in some ways. This is just a different way of modifying the genes. One study asked American adults if a genetically modified tomato that had a fish gene in it, would that taste fishy? And fewer than half American adults correctly identified that it wouldn't. They seem to think of this as, you know, essence of tomato and essence of fish coming together. And so you get something like an anchovy pizza. Okay, so that they don't really have a very nuanced understanding about how the genetically modified products, what they would be like. One other study found that 70% of opponents to GMO products here view GMOs as an absolute moral value. And what it means to say that it's an absolute moral value, that they judge it to be immoral regardless of any harms or benefits that it might have. If it could reduce harm or create benefits, it didn't matter. Those didn't matter. It was people, 70% of people view it as wrong regardless. It's just wrong, regardless of what benefits it might have. And another study had found that across many different countries around the world, when people are told about a transgenic transformation, that is taking a gene from a very different species, like a fish, into a tomato, that's going to cause more harm than a cisgenic one, where it's from a similar species. So in our same study with the eugenics questionnaire, we also gave participants a measure of their attitudes towards GMOs. And some sample items are: how risky would you say GM foods are in terms of risk to human health? How willing are you to consume food products with genetically modified ingredients? Biotechnology will improve our lives in the next 20 years. Or how willing would you be to purchase genetically modified foods if it was more nutritious than similar food that isn't genetically modified? And on average, we found that our two measures of genetic essentialism correlated negatively with support for GMO products. So the more that people view genes to be like essences and underlying the underlying cause of how things come out the way they are, the more concerned people are with efforts to modify the genomes in their food supply. So What I found encouraging in this research and this in the same paper is that these attitudes towards eugenics and GMO food seem to be something that are modifiable, that genetics education helps. We included a measure of genetics knowledge, a test at the end of just how much people understood some basic principles of genetics. And people with better knowledge about genetics score lower on these measures of essentialism, that they don't think of genes like essences, those who know more about genes. And they those who knew more about genes were less likely to support eugenics, that eugenics was more associated with a faulty understanding of genetics. And people who had better understanding about genes were more in support of GMOs as well. So genetics education seems to be a way out of here. So just to conclude, that people are affected by genetics information differently than they're affected by other kinds of information. We don't process all information equally, that some kinds of arguments weigh more heavily on us than others. And I think genes, arguments about genes do, because people tend to think of genes like essences. We project all these intuitions that we have about essences onto genes, and we think of anything that involves genes as operating ways similar to essences. And this genetic essentialism is associated with greater support for eugenics and more fears about GMO products. And an important research goal remains to identify when people are most influenced by genetic arguments, when, what kinds of situations make them more prone to think in essentialist terms. Just a plug for my book, I have discussed these ideas in much more detail in my book, DNA is Not Destiny. So thank you very much.
That's really interesting. Thank you, Steve. That was very interesting. And I have to say, generated quite a lot of chat, much more so than normal. So you've definitely got people thanking here. I'll say, because there was so much going on in the chat, if you actually left a question you want Steve to answer, could you just copy and paste it back again so we can get to it? And while you do that, I'll take David Andow's question, if you'd like to unmute yourself.
Hi, thank you for a very interesting talk. The last results that you showed, which were that knowledge about genetics changed these, could you elaborate a little bit more in terms of what knowledge about genetics may have been responsible for changing these ideas?
Yeah, no, that's a good question, because our test was, it was a test that's been used in a number of other similar kinds of studies by other researchers. It was a general genetics knowledge test. So knowing some just technical things, so like, you know, knowing that genes are on chromosomes, knowing something about how relatives share different proportions of their genes, knowing a little bit about meiosis. There are questions largely about, yeah, some just technical factors. We didn't look more carefully if any single question on there had a stronger relation than other questions. We didn't look at that. So we just had sort of their overall score on this, which I think reflected perhaps how much genetics education people have had.
So maybe a follow-up, just you're mentioning those three items. The second one, in terms of relative sharing proportion of genes, that sort of folds into the essentialism part that you were just talking about, whereas the others may not be clearly associated with essentialism. So I'm wondering if you can, if there's a way of separating out some of these genetic information items into these essentialist, your perspective, yeah, essentialism versus not, and see what happens there.
Yeah, that would really be interesting. I would be interested too in just seeing, ideally, in following people through genetics education in university, and seeing how a very concentrated course on or program on genetics training ultimately comes to shape people here. But yeah, we didn't try to distinguish those items. And I think you're right that some of those items perhaps are more aligned with intuitions about essences. And I would just want to say that I don't think all intuitions about essences are necessarily wrong. I think many of those intuitions do. I mean, genes can be transferred. I mean that, right? I mean that our kids do share our genes for instance. And that, you know, and genes do really contribute to make who we are. It's not that genes don't have these contributions, but just that I think people have an overly exaggerated sense of how much they do. But yeah, I think it's something we haven't done, but I think that would be interesting to look at, yeah, the different kinds of knowledge that people have about genetics and how much those predict these kinds of findings that we have. So that'd be a good thing to look up.
Okay, we have a question from Fred Gould in the chat. What other things about people's backgrounds correlate with their genetic knowledge and could influence their answers?
Yeah, that's interesting. So political attitudes are associated with essentialism. And so perhaps people's political attitudes might relate to education in some way. I don't know if those would be especially strong correlations. To look at, maybe then I think sort of underlying that question is it's not so much that learning about genes is affecting people, making them less essentialistic in their way of thinking, but maybe that there are different kinds of people to begin with, that people have sort of different predispositions towards essentialism, and those might overlap with predispositions to pursue education. I think political orientation may be one. Everyone who with a high school diploma should have a fair bit of exposure to genetics knowledge. And another factor then, intelligence itself probably relates both to the one's performance on a genetic test and perhaps to their tendency to essentialize genetics. There's some thoughts on that.
I'm curious, you didn't mention confirmation bias in your studies. Does that, I'm a geneticist, so, psychology is, outside of my realm. Is that accounted for, or is that included in the way you analyze your data?
Not in these studies here, because in these studies here, I would think confirmation bias would be relevant to the extent that of sort of one's pre-existing views and beliefs on genetics, and then encountering an argument that either fits with that or is at odds with that. And so in our studies, we are averaging across our sample who were in that condition. And likewise, in our correlational studies, we're looking sort of across the whole population, which kind of beliefs clustered together. So I think confirmation bias is probably influencing the way that people responded to our manipulations, and that people would respond differently, and some might, just not believe them, and where others, if it fits their pre-existing biases, they'd be especially likely to believe them. But I think for us to be able to determine that, we should measure people's attitudes prior to giving them this manipulation, and that's something that we hadn't done. But I think that would be a way of addressing the role that confirmation bias plays in this.
Okay, great. Thank you. The chat's jumping. Let me check here. Tajay Howard says, why not be worried about things that are genetically modified? Different qualities can directly alter what happens to the body when it is consumed. Proteins and carbohydrates can differ, which would overall make what I expect to be consuming completely different. Although with allergies and GMOs not identifying what was changed, it could cause adverse effects. So the question is, why not be worried about GMOs?
Yeah. Well, I think there are many reasons that people are worried about them. So, for instance, I personally don't like that they are that big companies sort of have somewhat of a monopoly on aspects of our food supply. I think they could change the ecosystem. I think there are a variety of reasons to be concerned about them. That, though, what some research suggests is that those generally aren't the main concerns for most GMO opponents. That most GMO opponents are bothered that it's wrong to modify the genes. And I would just point out that just because something's modified through direct genetic modification, I mean, all of our food products have been had their genes modified since the first time our food supply was domesticated. There's selection that, you know, we selected the wheat that had hardier stalks with bigger seeds. That changes the genes. And the variety of pre-GMO kinds of technologies of hybridization or using radiation to prompt mutations, that those are seen as non-GMO technologies. They all of them modify the genes. But the idea that modifying, I think just the active goal of getting in there and modifying genes is many people view what this research suggests, that that's the part that they view as problematic, as playing God is often a common reason that people offer for why GMO is problematic. And I think it also, I think we have this naturalistic fallacy. I think that natural is good, that natural is healthy too. I think people often don't attend to, well, there's a lot of dangers in the natural world too. There's, you know, you eat green potatoes or rhubarb, there's cyanide in almonds. There's a lot of our natural products that are toxic. But those don't scare us in the same way as the kinds of fears that we imagine that, you know, scientists playing with genomes is going to create some dangers. So I do think that there are many reasons why people are concerned about GMOs and for a variety of different concerns. But I do think a very common one, though, is just that this bothers them and that it seems immoral in some way. That, and I think because it's seen as unnatural and playing God.
Apologies, my mouse wasn't working to unmute myself. Thank you for that answer. We do have, so we're about out of time, but I do want to encourage you to check out the chat. There's been quite a lot of reaction to your example of girls are bad at math and stories about how women were told that they couldn't do math as a youngster. Put my own story there, but yes, I was also, you know, told that is very common. So if you're interested in that, there's quite a good discussion.
I see this. Yes.
Yeah. And with that, I want everyone to help me thank Steve for a really interesting and engaging talk. And I want to piggyback on one of his slides with the tomato fish. Next week, our speaker is from Aqua Bounty, and they actually developed the GMO salmon. So he'll be here talking about an actual GM fish and not a pretend GMO fish. But that will be next week, and that will be in person and online. So if you're on campus, join us at the 1911 building. And with that, help me thank Steve, and have a good week.
Thanks so much, everyone. Feel free to email me if you're interested.